sharing the world with you as always. And our topic for tonight is friendship. How can we get good friendships? How can we develop? How can we strengthen them? How can we forge really strong friendships? And the reason we're looking at that tonight is because we're studying some episodes from the early life of David. Last week we had one of the most famous fights ever in the whole of literature, David versus Goliath. This week our passage focuses on one of the most famous friendships in literature, that between David and Jonathan. What can we learn from it? I wonder if you've ever thought about how to start good friendships. I went to my niece's wedding a few weeks ago, and her father was giving a speech, and he was always saying he really liked the friends that Sophie had chosen. And he was a bit surprised about that, because he remembered back to her school days when anyone who wanted to be her friend was given quite a lengthy application form of about 3 pages, and they had to fill it in. And he was saying, surprisingly, none of the people that had been given that form were there at the wedding today. Now, needless to say, that leads to God's new side of the family, all the social skills problems, but I won't be surprised to hear it, so we're not. Okay, so how can we make good friends? How can we strengthen our friendships? We're going to look at the example of David and Jonathan and see what we can learn from it. I'm just going to start by, we've got a long passage, I'm going to start by reading a couple of short sections to give us a flavour of what's going on in this bit of the story of David and Jonathan. So I'm going to start with 1 Samuel 19, verses 1 to 7. And you can follow it in the Bibles if you've got them, or just listen. Saul spoke with his son Jonathan and with all his servants about killing David. But Saul's son Jonathan took great delight in David. Jonathan told David, "My father Saul is trying to kill you. Therefore be on guard tomorrow morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. If I learn anything, I will tell you." Jonathan spoke well of David to his father Saul, saying to him, "The king should not sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have been of good service to you. For he took his life in his hands when he attacked the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great victory for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against an innocent person by killing David without cause?" Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." So Jonathan called David and related all these things to him. Jonathan then brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. And then the next chapter, chapter 20, verses 13 to 17, let me just read another short section. This is Jonathan talking to David. "But if my father intends to do you harm, the Lord do the same to Jonathan, and more also if I don't warn you, if I don't disclose it to you, and send you away so that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, show me the faithful love of the Lord. But if I die, never cut off your faithful love from my house, even if the Lord were to cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." Thus Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord seek out the enemies of David." Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own life. So as I say, this is one of the most famous friendships ever, and our passage tonight is really these two chapters, 19 and 20. But I want to go back to the very first verse after the story that we had from Torquil last week about David and Goliath, and that's chapter 18, verse 1, because in a way, this one verse encapsulates everything that we need to think about in terms of friendship. So let me read 1 Samuel 18, verse 1. This is straight after the David and Goliath fight. "When David had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." That's it. Let me read it again. "The soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. There are three things, just in those few words, that are really the three things I want us to think about tonight in terms of friendship. First of all, the phrase, he loved him as his own soul, conveys the depth of the relationship, the depth of the affection that was there. Loved and soul, that's the inner being, inner self. This was a deep relationship. Secondly, the word bound. The soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David. There's a very strong commitment there. So there's deep affection, there's strong commitment. And then the word soul itself, what does that mean? What's the difference between your soul and your inner self? Well, when the Bible talks about the soul, it's talking about the inner self, but in relationship to God. So this was a relationship, soul to soul, that was God-centered. So three points, and as Kate said tonight, we'll make them all begin with C to make it nice and simple. Deep affection, we'll call that close, this is a close friendship. It was a committed friendship, and it was centred on God. Okay, those are the points that we're going to bring out in the passage. But the way the Bible teaches us about friendship is not with a lecture, but with a story. So let's do a quick gallop through this story of David and Jonathan and pick up what we can as we go along. So in chapter 18, David, you know, fresh from defeating Goliath, goes from strength to strength. He has more victories against the Philistines, and he's impressing everybody, particularly the women. And I think Torquil read this passage up last week. Chapter 18, verses 7 to 9. And the women sang to one another as they made merry, Saul has killed his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. Saul was very angry, for this saying displeased him. He said, they ascribed to David 10,000, and to me they ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day on. So that was Saul's reaction to David's success. Jealousy, envy, hostility. It started there. What about Jonathan's reaction? Let me read to you a couple of verses before that. Again, just after David has come to fame and defeated Goliath. 18 verse 4, Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David, and his armour, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. So Jonathan, the prince of Israel, presumably the heir to the throne, could have been likely very jealous and hateful towards David, has a completely different reaction. And Saul even points this out to Jonathan. He can't understand why Jonathan's taking David's side. In chapter 20, verse 31, for as long as the son of Jesse, that's David, lives on earth, neither you, Jonathan, nor your kingdom shall be established. But amazingly, and I've never really thought about this background to the friendship before, how much Jonathan had to lose by his friendship with David. But he refuses to go down that jealous hatred route, in contrast to his father. And the rest of chapter 18 basically sees Saul going from bad to worse. He tries to kill David twice. Once, when David's playing the harp, he throws his javelin at him, tries to pin him to the wall. Then he comes up with a ruse to entice David to marry his daughter, Michal, if he will only kill 100 Philistines first, which Saul thinks he's bound to get killed doing that. But, surprise, surprise, David manages to do it, and he marries Michal. And the next chapter sees Michal having to save David's life. He's asleep in bed. Saul sends his men to kill him. She actually lowers David down through a window in a basket and puts a dummy in the bed, which gets speared. Like that. It's kind of James Bond stuff. And this is all within, amazing thing, this is all within two chapters of David defeating Goliath, you know, the most famous victory of Israel in the Old Testament. And this is how Saul treats him. It really is an example in the dangers of envy and jealousy, which is a great barrier to friendship. And we can see that it's not only destroyed the relationship between Saul and David and between Saul and God, but really destroyed the whole person of Saul, the whole personality. And, you know, a few verses later, he's going into some kind of mad frenzy, thrashing about naked, really descending into madness. And it all comes through that jealousy of David. But Jonathan is a great contrast to that. And I was reading this week a chapter of a book by Chuck Colson, who runs a worldwide prison fellowship. And the reason he got into that was because he was an inmate in prison himself. And the reason for that is that he was one of President Nixon's chief advisors, really the architect of the whole Watergate political scandal. He was one of the top guilty men. He went to jail for it. And there he was converted, and now he spends his time ministering to prisoners. And he just wrote this sentence which kind of hit me. He was really saying how prison and his downfall had been a blessing to him. The object of life is not to achieve money, power, and pleasure. That's not the Holy Grail. That's what he was doing before. The object of life is the maturity of the soul. And you reflect that maturity of the soul when you care for other people more than yourself. And that's what's exemplified by Jonathan here and his friendship with David. Chapter 20 goes on in the same vein. There's an episode where David and Jonathan are discussing, you know, whether Saul still wants to kill David. And Jonathan says, no, you'd never do it without telling me. And, you know, David, not surprisingly, after what's gone before, is not so sure. And they come up with a plan where David will hide out in the bush and miss the palace feast. And if Saul is angry that David's not there, then Jonathan will know that Saul still wants to kill him. But if Saul accepts the excuses, I had to go to a family wedding in Bethlehem, then all is well. And the plan was that so David didn't have to show his face, Jonathan would give a sign by shooting some arrows into the bush. And with a prearranged sign, David would know whether it was safe to come back to the palace and Saul or not. Surprise, surprise, Saul accepts the excuse the first night that David is away, and the second night, when Jonathan gives David's excuses, he flies into a rage. He blames Jonathan. Jonathan himself nearly gets pinned to the wall by a javelin. He's so mad with rage that he nearly kills his own son. And Jonathan does as he vowed to do in that passage I read you. He gives the warning to David, which means that David escapes and they will never see each other again. And there's an emotional farewell scene in chapter 20, verses 41 and 42. As soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept with each other. David wept the more. Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since both of us have sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" He got up and left, and Jonathan went back to the city. So what can we learn about this friendship that the Bible gives us as a model? What can we learn about friendships for ourselves? As I say, the ingredients that came out for me were this closeness, this deep affection, strong commitment, and having God at the centre. So first of all, the deep affection. Remember that verse that I read you right at the beginning, chapter 18, verse 1. This is right after David has first appeared on the scene and defeated Goliath. No one knew who he was before. Jonathan didn't know who he was. But that debt, that soul-to-soul bond, comes very early. So these were two men who sparked. There was a spark there as soon as they met each other. And that is something about friendship. There is a secret ingredient, an X factor there. That probably involves seeing things the same way. So, you know, David and Jonathan spark because they have a similar way of doing the world. Neither of them can sit around watching God be mocked and inactivity happening. We saw that last week with David and Goliath. I don't know if you probably don't remember, but I read you one of my favourite passages about Jonathan's heroics. A few chapters earlier, when he got fed up with his father's inactivity, waiting to see if God was guiding him to take on the Philistines, he grabbed his servant and his sword and he went on and he said, "We'll find out if God's on our side. We'll either die or God will give us victory." So he was a man of action as well. And, that's something about friendships. You can't necessarily force them. C.S. Lewis wrote quite a famous essay on friendship. And he said, the start of a friendship usually begins not with the words, "Will you be my friend?" but more likely, "What, you too? You think that way too? I thought I was the only one." People, there's got to be a spark there, we can't force it. And it usually involves some common way of looking at things. And these men didn't meet at the local youth club or some dinner party, they met on the battlefield doing kingdom work. And that's a lesson to us, I think. If we feel we'd like to develop more friendships or better friendships in church, maybe the answer is not to join another fellowship group, but it's to get involved in some area of service in the church, either with the children, or with the youth, or with the leadership, or with the soup kitchen, or whatever it is. And that comradeship will lead to a deepening affection. These men went through great adventures together, and that is what converted that initial spark of friendship into such a strong friendship. I think C.S. Lewis again said, lovers are face to face, they're absorbed in each other. Friendships are facing in the same direction, they're on a journey together, not preoccupied with their relationship, but side by side going forward together, which is a nice picture of the friendship that we see here. So that's the first point then, a deep affection which we can't force. We can really pray that God will provide us with people in our lives where that possibility exists. Some spark of affection, some similar way of seeing things. Let's pray that God will provide us with people like that and that we will be open to receive that gift of friendship. But having said that, that is not enough. Yeah, there's the closeness of the natural spark there, but the second element is commitment, and it's strong commitment that we see here. Commitment which is explicitly expressed actually in covenant vows, which comes as a surprise to us in the context of friendship. Let me read 20 verse 6, I think it is. Let me give us an example. Thus Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord seek out the enemies of David. Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him. So this was overtly expressed commitment in a covenant. And what did that commitment involve? It involved cost, and obviously a huge cost for Jonathan. What did it cost Jonathan? Any hope of a future kingdom? Cost his relationship with his father, and it almost cost him his life. So, once you've taken javelins for each other, that is a friendship that is strong and growing. How many friends do we have in our lives where we've been prepared to sacrifice family relationships, time with family, careers? Do we have that kind of friendship and that attitude, that expectation from friendship? So there was a cost to it, but there was also a tremendous trust. If we look at chapter 20 and verse 4, then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. Now, that's, to be quite frank, that's the sort of thing I don't want my daughters saying to their friends of either sex. That's a dangerous thing to say, that level of commitment to the being. But obviously the context here is complete trust that whatever David did tell him to do would be the right thing. So there's a huge element of trust there. Cost, trust, and the last thing is that this commitment, because it was expressed as a covenant, actually outlasted their own lives. We've read it already. If I am still alive, show me the faithful love of the Lord. But if I die, never cut off your faithful love from my house. Okay, and so in other words, they're committing each other to the welfare of their children as well as to each other. And there's a very moving story later on in 2 Samuel chapter 9 where David is king, Jonathan has died, and he discovers that Jonathan had a disabled son called Mephibosheth who was living as a beggar in squalor somewhere. And when he finds this out, he is full of remorse and brings Mephibosheth to the palace and clothes him in beautiful clothes and really honours him because of the friendship that he had with his father. So again, that's a lesson for us. How many of us are godparents? And I don't mean in the traditional formal Anglican sense of the word, but I mean how many of us feel a commitment to each other's children and a trust that if something happened to us, we could trust our friends completely for the welfare of our children. Do we expect this kind of level of commitment from our friendships? Some people have looked at this passage and said, well, you know, there must be more to it than friendship, quite frankly. This language about this depth of affection, this covenantal commitment. And there's a famous lament that David says when he hears the news of Jonathan and Saul's death at the beginning of 2 Samuel, which I've said one of my favourite poems in, you know, the whole of the Bible, if not Christian, really because of the tenderness of the way David speaks, not only about Jonathan, but about his enemy, Saul. So let me just read you these words, and they're famous, you'll recognise them. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the street of Ashkelon. The bow of Jonathan did not turn back, nor the sword of Saul turn empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely in life and death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Jonathan lies slain upon your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Greatly beloved you were to me. Your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perish. And you can see people have taken this kind of language and said, well, you know, maybe there was a romantic, a homosexual relationship between Jonathan and David. You can almost see why with this language. Of course, some people are doing it because of their own sympathies or orientation. They're genuinely looking for something positive that the Bible might say about homosexuality. So they look to this. But I'm afraid, from that point of view, I don't think the evidence, there's no scholarly evidence to back up any suggestion of a romantic or sexual relationship between them. And the fact that we even think along those lines, actually, I think is a big teaching point for all of us, which is that I think we devalue friendship. We don't expect this level of affection and commitment from friendship. If we see it there, we think there must be something else. And you know, I think that's influenced by the media as well. I don't do social media, but Facebook, I can imagine, encourages us to measure friendships by quantity rather than quality. Even our, you know, TV and film is really much more obsessed with romantic relationships than friendship. And even, you know, the famous series that my daughter spent hours watching, which is all about friendship, it's all Friends. From my viewing of it, most of the time it's exploring who is pairing off with who, who's having a romantic relationship with who. And of course, the ultimate question in the whole series was, would Ross end up with Rachel or not? So even something that is supposed to be about friendship ends up being preoccupied with the romantic kind of love rather than friendship love. But the Bible does value friendship, and it has very high standards, as are shown here. And if we're going to aim for this kind of standard of friendship, we can't have too many, because it's just going to be too costly for us. So it's quality that the Bible looks for, not quantity. Are we prepared to pay the cost? You know, for us, it's hopefully not going to lead us to lose our lives, as it might have done for Jonathan. But it's certainly going to involve a time cost, maybe time away from our family, the expense of our careers, and the cost is real. So, a deep affection, a strong commitment, and finally, God at the centre. Chapter 20 and verse 42, I think I've already read it. Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since both of us have sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants.'" So David and Jonathan are the closest friends that we have in history, or we have in literature, but there was something between them, and that something was someone, was the Lord himself. Reminding me of Ecclesiastes 4, verse 12, which probably some of you are familiar with. It's always been a verse that Ruth and I have as a kind of symbol of our marriage, and I'm sure we're not the only ones. It says this: although one might prevail, two will withstand one, But a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So the idea is that, you know, a single strand is weak, a double strand is slightly stronger, but a three-corded strand, that's hopefully me, Ruth, and God, is strong, strong and lasting. And I've heard that read at other weddings as well. But if you look back at the passage in Ecclesiastes, the title is Teaching About Friendship. Again, the Bible has high standards of commitment and teaches that God should be at the center of our friends. Now, why is that? Why do we say that the secret of friendship is to have God at the center? Is it because we're in church and so, you know, God's always the answer? Like the Sunday school kid put up his hand before the question came and said, Jesus. Whatever the question, the answer is Jesus. Is that why I'm saying that God has to be at the centre? Well, yeah, he did have a point back here, I think. but there's more to it than that. And it comes out of what the Christian faith teaches about our relationship with God. I don't know if you remember the last time I was speaking, we were thinking about the fear of God, and saying maybe we neglect that a bit, we're in danger of creating God in our own image, having a pet God who will never disagree with us. And we thought about that, and it's important. But fear of the Lord is not unique to the Christian faith. But what is unique to the Christian faith is the idea of friendship with God. And that's, you know, even more important. Although fear is reverent awe is important, friendship with God is something that's unique to the gospel. Jesus says this in John chapter 15 to his disciples, I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing, but I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I've heard from my Father. So he's explicitly moving the disciples' status from servants to friends, and there's full trust and full disclosure of his plans. And he goes on, as you know, in chapter 17, to pray for us, the people that will believe in him through the disciple, and to pray that we will have that same relationship, that same friendship with God. And that is an amazing thing that's unique to the gospel. And, you know, Jesus is obviously the ultimate expression of God's desire to be friends with us. He would send prophets, he would write the Bible, inspire the words of Scripture as a way of revealing himself to us, but that wasn't enough. It was never going to be enough for God. And eventually he rolls up his sleeves and comes in person to befriend us. And although Jesus is the ultimate expression of that, we can see it right from the beginning of the Bible. In Genesis 3, we see the Lord God taking a walk in the garden at the time of the evening breeze, looking for Adam and Eve. So you look at books on the history of religion, we think about man's search for God. But the Bible starts with God searching for man. And even back there, right at the beginning, the implications of that, of God's desire for friendship with man, the implications of that in terms of our relationships with each other is quite clear. So, Kate sent me a talk by Steve Chalk recently, and I like what he said at the beginning of it. He said, you know, sometimes we think, you know, I, Richard, am made in God's image. You, Kevin, are made in God's image. But what the Bible actually says is that we, together, are made in God's image. And the words say, let us make humankind in our image. Let us, that's God speaking, let us make humankind in our image. And let them have dominion over all the animals. So God is almost defining himself in terms of relationship there. He's referring to himself as us. And implying that, you know, when we are made in his image, part of that is our need for relationship with each other. And he goes on in the next chapter explicitly, famously, to say it is not good that man should be alone. So we, you know, relationship, friendship is integral to God's own character and therefore to ours. So the reason that God needs to be the centre of every friendship is not just because Jesus is always the answer to every question, but it goes right back to our creation order and what we were made for. So strong friendships, deep affection, strong commitment, and God at the centre. And what I want to do is lead straight on to the communion now, because what I want to do is to think about, as we celebrate, as we share bread and wine together, what it reminds us about our friendship with God. So if I can have a bit of help. So we talked about God taking, the Lord God taking a walk in the evening breeze in the Garden of Eden. What did you find when you went for a walk looking for Adam and Eve? You couldn't find them because they were hiding from him, no? Because of what they'd done. So God was looking for friendship, but we were hiding from him. And in order to restore that friendship that God longed for, that was not an easy task for him. It cost him everything.